Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also happy to have back here on the program once again Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. It's a program we do every month. It's always on a Monday, and we give you the chance to call in and ask questions about home maintenance. If you have some kind of problem and you're not quite sure how to solve it, pick up the telephone and give us a call, and Scott will do his best to help you out. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much, David. Always a pleasure to be here.
Well, if people have been paying attention to the weather forecast, we're expecting here in our area and a lot of central Illinois over the next couple of days some significant rain. In fact, there's a flood watch that's out starting, I think, depending on where you are, this afternoon, tomorrow, it goes through Wednesday morning. And I think I heard Mola talking this morning about the possibility of several inches of rain. So I guess if you haven't done this, you should make sure that you got your downspouts on. They are at least, 3 feet away. You want them at least 3 feet from the foundation?
3 feet for crawl space foundations, and preferably up to 5 on a basement foundation.
Okay. And if you can, make sure that your gutters are doing what you want them to, because you want to get that water that hits the roof and comes down as far away from the foundation as you can.
Yeah. Right now, at this point in time, the soil moisture content is quite high. Not quite as bad a problem as what we had a few weeks ago when we had the several inches of snow and all of a sudden a little bit of rain. At that point in time, all the gutters were full of snow and ice and it did not work well. But right now we do have a fairly high moisture content in the soil. So a little bit of additional moisture could mean for wet basements and wet crawl spaces.
Yeah. So, and other than making sure that, again, you got your downspouts on and they're far away from the foundation, and whatever you can do, you know, if your gutters are blocked and you can get them clean, obviously you want them to run and do what they're supposed to do. Probably not too much else.
Not a bad idea to check the sump pump before you need it. Make sure that the battery backup works. Make sure that the electric system is operating properly, things like that. So, yeah, there is a very good chance that with the weather we're going to have in the next couple of days that we could get an influx of wet basements and wet crawl spaces. Something new for this year. Not really. I'm kidding.
Yeah. Well, this winter, particularly, it's been a very wet winter, and I suppose there's some people who, you know, are going to have problems no matter what. But I expect there are also people who have had some water problems this winter that would have said, well, the past few years we've been doing okay. We really haven't had a problem.
That is absolutely correct. I've been getting some phone calls here that people that haven't had water in basements for 8-10 years, actually since the last time we had a nice rain after a good hard rainfall or a snowfall.
Yeah.
When we get cold weather and the ground freezes and we get a lot of snow, then the snow tends to block the downspouts. It tends to build up around the outside of the foundation, and we get a little bit of rain like this and water just doesn't run away. And it's amazing how many basements haven't been wet or how many crawl spaces haven't been flooded that were this year. So I've been keeping busy running around trying to find ways of drying things out.
Okay. Well, we got a caller here in Lafayette. We'll get right with them on our line four. Hello.
Well, about roof gutters then, if they're full of ice blocking up, should we try to remove it?
Well, there is really no good way of removing ice that is blocking the gutters, and that is a problem when we have strange weather combinations, such as very cold weather and lots of snow, and then all of a sudden warms up 20 degrees, which it likes to do around here, and a lot of rain. There's really not much we can do about it. If you get up on your roof and try and take a little bit of ice out of the gutters, a lot of times it just doesn't want to come out. Your gutter supports are preventing it from coming out, so there's actually, it's one of those things we're kind of stuck with it. And the only way to really help the house is to ensure that your drainage around the outside slopes away from the house so that water that drips off the gutters or doesn't fit in the gutters will drain away from the foundation instead of towards it.
All right. Regardless, then, of the carryout spouts.
Yeah. It's the problem we ran into here last month was that the gutters just would not work because they were already full of ice, so the water overflowed the gutters.
And yet there's no way to empty them.
Right. There's no way to empty them. The downspouts were frozen or blocked, and the gutters themselves were frozen. It's the only thing we can do is the grating around the outside.
What about those electric cables?
Those work well in some cases. The electric cables work a lot pretty well for helping on ice damming, low pitch roofs. You can have the ones that go in the gutter, but around here the need for them is, you know, like I say, it's only when we have this weather combination that we've had lately, and to put in something to combat something that happens once every 5 to 8 years, I'm not sure it makes a lot of sense, because my opinion is you put it in there, and when you need it 5 to 8 years later from now, it's not going to work.
Okay, they don't address the problem then.
Yeah.
Let me ask then, how do I most effectively stop leaks in the overlapping sections? This is a steel gutter.
Okay. Well, steel gutters do expand and contract, as do aluminum gutters. Most aluminum gutters don't have a lot of seams. Your steel gutters usually have a seam every 20 feet or at all the corners.
Mm-hmm.
You'll want to use a butyl caulk, which is B-U-Y-T-L, a butyl caulk, which is a non-hardening caulk, something that will allow for a little bit of flex, a little bit of movement. A silicone caulk can work, but the silicone used usually will peel up after a couple of years and doesn't do much good for you. The
butyl caulk, then, that's the chewing gum stuff.
Yes, that's correct.
Anything else? Any kind of overlapping patch?
Well, usually the butyl will take care of it. There are some adhesive tapes that if you have an extreme problem, something that's really moving. I have seen some houses with 40, 45-foot length sections of gutter, which could use something. They do make some modified bituminous tape or flashing tape, and that can be used in there. But generally speaking, the butyl caulk will take care of it.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Certainly. Okay. Thank you.
Other questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. You know, at our house, we got some new gutters finally, which is something we really needed, and that was a good thing. The thing I've noticed here and there around the house, there are places where instead of the water running down and dripping into the gutter, it drips down the back and it's running down the fascia. Is that a common problem?
Well, ideally, the drip edge, which is a metal flashing that goes up underneath the shingles and down over the fascia, is supposed to be installed over the back side of the gutter so that doesn't happen. Now, the gutters do have a slope, so it's not all that common that at the one end of the gutter it's tucked up underneath the drip edge, and at the other end of the gutter where the downspout is, the gutter's low enough to where water could run off back along the drip edge and back behind the gutter, in which case you get a piece of aluminum flashing and kind of tuck it up behind the drip edge and then lap that into the gutter. There should always be a metal flashing or a metal trim piece lapping over the back of the gutter so the back of the gutters are not exposed.
Okay. Another caller here, someone in Geneva. This is line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Yeah, I was just going to make a comment real quick. I found out with my gutters, that if I don't do the maintenance on it, I know people don't like this issue of not doing any maintenance. They hate the fact that they have to do anything to the house. It seems to me whenever I clean them out every year religiously, I'll clean them both in the fall and the spring. And the gutters seem to really work good. I've only had one spot in the whole gutter system where I've had to go back a couple of times. But every year I check it, make sure all my seams and everything are okay. Now, what do you recommend maintenance-wise? I mean, I know a lot of people have two-story homes and they can't get to them. But is there something you could tell people? Because it's got to be done.
Yeah, maintenance on gutters is one of those things that it's all dependent on your area around you. If you're in a newer area with only a few smaller trees, the gutters require very little maintenance. If you're in a nice, well-established neighborhood and you've got five sycamore trees that are 60 feet tall around the house, you know, your gutter's going to block up on a regular basis. Pine needles also are another thing. So a lot of it has to do with exactly where your location is.
And when you're talking about maintenance, are you talking about anything more than simply keeping them clean?
As a general rule, clean is about the only thing you need to do with gutters. You do have to make sure that the downspouts are secured to the wall so that the wind doesn't blow them around. Make sure the extensions are secured to the elbows so that the water gets out and away. But, yeah, gutters are pretty easy to deal with. It's just that if you get some tree debris or loose shingles or something sliding in there, I tell you what, I get on an awful lot of roofs where I'm looking down in the gutter and there's a tennis ball stuck in the opening of the gutter. The kids liking to play ball and bounce them off the driveway and hit them up on the roof and it rolls down into the gutter. And that tennis ball is almost the exact correct size to fit that little hole in the gutter. And you can block up a gutter with a tennis ball and, wow, it doesn't work too well.
All right. Well, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You want to call in here, talk with Scott Spies. It's our monthly show on home maintenance. Next up, we'll talk with someone here where we are in Champaign-Urbana. This is Champaign, and it's line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning, Scott. I have a question on sump pumps.
Okay.
The proper way to hook a sump pump up so that it operates both springtime and through the winter.
Okay.
So it doesn't freeze up on the outside, and you don't have to have basically a hose run along across your lawn.
Okay, well, it's one of those things where the better the drainage around the outside and the better you pay attention to your guttering, the less you'll need a sump pump. Ideally, the sump pump does not run much in the wintertime because we're not getting as much groundwater. We're not getting as much water running down along next to the foundation. But a sump pump should come out through the foundation. If you've got an area where you can come in out below grade and go to a drainage system, such as a storm sewer, that will work. Most of them come out of the foundation just above grade. You want to make sure that there is a slope on the pipe so that it does not hold water, so that it drains the water out. In extremely cold weather, that pipe will get cold, and I have seen them ice up. Some people will have a secondary pipe that will go out, and usually a flexible pipe, something that they can use as a backup opening in case that primary does block up. But ideally, the thing you do is make sure that the groundwater stays away from the foundation so the sump pump doesn't have to run in that type of weather. We don't have, if it's freezing outside, if it's 10 degrees outside and well below freezing, everything's solid, we usually don't have a lot of sump pump activity because we don't have a lot of water running down there. So the only thing I can say at this point is to make sure that you have a good downhill slope on that pipe so that it doesn't have water sitting in it that will allow it to freeze and create an ice plug.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. So just to review, it is acceptable to have your sump pump connected to the storm sewer?
In some areas, you can do it. It's one of those things where you're not connected. You're not supposed to connect it direct in most areas, but you end up running it to the surface somewhere near the storm sewer where it goes into it. There are some areas where they do allow you to connect directly to a storm tile, in which case you can keep everything below grade so it doesn't freeze. Mm-hmm. In our particular area, in Champaign County, most of the county doesn't have inspectors. In the city, the inspectors will say, no, we're not supposed to do that. Some of the subdivisions are designed where the storm sewers are intended for direct connections to the sump pumps. So it all depends on where you're at as to whether or not that's an acceptable way of doing it. Mm-hmm. Most part, putting the sump pump directly to the storm sewer is something that the builder would do at the time of development of the area. If you've already got a house existing and decide you need a sump pump at a later date, you're going to need to run it out on the surface.
Okay. Well, again, questions welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It's our monthly show on home maintenance. The guest is Scott Spies. He's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. So what exactly is the sump pump intended to do? And is that really just a kind of a symptom treatment that shouldn't be your major way of dealing with water problems if you've got that kind of problem around your house?
Well, that's correct, David. For most of the areas we have around here, we don't actually have enough water table to where the water level in the soil is high enough to come up into the basement or crawl space area. Most of the time what we've got is a very high clay content in the soil in this area, so we have very little percolation or water soaking down into the ground. We get a lot of surface drainage. Mm-hmm. So if we can work on the outside of the house and get the surface drainage out and away from the house, keep the guttering clean, keep the downspouts extended out past the little ridge that tends to form. After you build the house, the soil next to the foundation settles a little bit. You need to go back in there and fill that so we don't have that slight moat around the outside of the house. There are areas where we have a lot of clay, and there are some areas, particularly to the east of us in the St. Joe Villa Grove area, where we can get some high water tables. And in those areas, what the sump pump is intended to do is keep the groundwater from coming up as high as what the basement floor is or the crawl space floor. For the most part around here, what the sump pump is doing is helping to reduce the chances of water buildup in a crawl space or basement from improper drainage around the exterior.
So, and though I think that it's right that mostly the problem, if people are having water in their basements, it's not that water is coming up from underneath so right. much as it is. It's the problem is the water that comes down, it hits the roof, runs off, comes right down right around the perimeter of the house. And then it soaks down into the soil right around the edges and then it comes in that way.
Even if you've got a quite old house, anytime you build a house, you have to dig down to put in the footing. Okay. On a crawl space foundation, the footing is 30, 40 inches deep. On a basement foundation, it's 8 to 10 feet deep or deeper. Well, when they put in that footing, they end up digging a fairly wide trench. They build the house in that trench, and then they backfill the remaining hole with looser dirt, fill dirt. And that fill dirt is always a little bit more absorbent than the undisturbed soil around the yard. So that fill dirt acts kind of like a sponge or an area where the water will percolate quite nicely and actually direct it towards the house. That's why we do recommend the 3-foot and the 5-foot downspout extensions, is to get the water from the guttering out past that softer or more absorbent soil area right directly next to the foundation. If you can do that, that'll help reduce the problem. What we had 5 or 6 weeks ago with our big snow, the ground was frozen and the snow was built up so that the water from the gutters didn't get away and out from the foundation, so it soaked in next to that really soft soil, and it ran right down along your foundation. We do not have too many areas in this area, or too many places in this area, where we have the water table itself, the soil saturation, actually create a hydronic pressure to push the water up through the basement floors. I can't say that there's no place here, and our area is large enough that I'm sure that there are other places where that can happen. And the only thing there is to, A, they should have built the basement higher. B, make sure you have a really, really good sump pump with a good backup, because there are going to be times when the water level comes up high enough, it's hard to keep it pumped out.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go on and talk to some other folks here. Lexington next. This is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi. Yeah. We are in the process of remodeling our basement and looking at backup systems for sump pumps. My sister just installed one that if the power goes out, it automatically switches to a water pressure system.
Okay.
So the pressure from their water is actually running the sump pump. I was just wondering if you had any opinion on that, pros and cons versus that versus a battery backup system.
Okay, all good questions. The battery backup system is effectively a 12-volt pump connected to usually a deep cycle battery, often associated with boats, RV, marine type use. It's actually a battery that's designed to be pulled way down and then charged back up, whereas an automotive battery is designed to have a quick current draw and then charged immediately. So a deep cycle battery is what you'd want to use for one of these 12-volt battery backup systems. Unfortunately, a 12-volt battery is susceptible to wear, and after the first 2 years or so, its efficiency starts dropping. So you end up having to replace the battery every 2 to 3 years. And the only way to know that the battery is bad is when you need it and all of a sudden the pump is not working. And the battery backup pumps in proper working condition are good for about 2 to 3 hours of pump time. And in most cases, that is more than adequate to keep things going. But if we have a period of time without power for, say, 3 to 5 days, which we had back in, I believe, 89 in this area, the battery backup's not going to work for you. The water powered actually connects up to city water and uses the water pressure that the city has, and they have backup systems in most places. and acts as a siphon pump. You set the float level for it above your standard pump so it doesn't come on a regular basis. But if the standard pump either fails or can't keep up, the water powered backup is activated, and it's a siphon pump. It takes about a gallon and a half of city water to siphon or draw a gallon of sump pump water out with it, and then both the city water and the sump pump water run out through your discharge. They are not as high a volume system as either the battery backup or your electric backup. So if you have a sump pump that has just water running through it, the battery backup may be a better option because the water powered cannot necessarily keep up with it. Also, the water power does not work if you have a well system.
Right.
Or if you're in a community that has a very low water pressure. I know in Champaign-Urbana, where we're at, as far as I know, the water company has only started to lose pressure one time in the last 45 years. So they have a pretty good track record. So for around here, they seem to work well. But obviously, they're not the answer in rural areas or areas on small independent systems.
What's the difference in cost between the two systems?
Well, I've looked at the water backup systems, and to be quite honest, they look like they should cost about $19.95. They're connected up with a section of garden hose. They're made out of an inexpensive plastic. They weigh less than a pound. But in reality, they pretty much cost about what your minimum deductible is on your homeowners. They're both in about the $250 to $300 range, but and maybe just a little bit more by the time you get somebody to install them for you.
Does it have to be professionally installed, or is that something to do it yourself? Homeowner could do themselves.
Somebody who's relatively handy and can understand instructions, they should be able to install it. It's one of those things where I really hate to tell people, yes, you can put it in yourself,
right.
Because you do have to do some soldering to connect up to a copper water supply system. If you've got steel, you've got to be able to figure out how to connect up to a pipe system. So it's not the really super easy type thing. It's not one of those things as easy as like cleaning your gutters. But it is something that somebody that's a little bit more versed with tools can handle.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. We'll go to another caller. Someone in Indiana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I had two questions. One related to the gutters. I've heard of a product, but I don't know the name of it. I guess that's what I'm searching for, that essentially sits in, almost fills up the gutter so that leaves cannot get in, and yet still allows a free flow of water through it. It's a porous type product. Are you aware of what that is or a name for it?
I don't have a name for it. I believe there's at least two different companies offering that type of thing. It's basically a plastic fill that you would put in there, a foam-based system that is quite porous, and so the water runs through it readily. But no, I do not have a brand name.
Okay. And my other question related to what type of septic systems are there out there, and which ones seem to be the most efficient, and what kind of prices are we typically talking about for a single-family home? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, prices vary from area to area. A septic system can be anything from a standard gravity percolation type system where you put in a septic tank, usually about 1,500 gallons, in the ground, and then you have a leach field where the water from the tank flows out into a series of perforated pipes over the top of a sand and gravel bed and allow the water to soak down into the ground, and the ground actually becomes the final filter. In areas with poor percolation or high clay contents, they do make several different individual sewer systems. Name brands, there's Jet Aeration, there's Clearstream, there's Multiflow, and these all usually use an aerobic bacteria rather than an anaerobic bacteria. The aerobic bacteria, of course, requires air to survive, so they have basically a bubbler system or a churning system that helps keep the water in the septic tank aerated so that the bacteria can dissolve the debris. Then they run it through a filter process, and if equipped with a chlorinating tube where you put in chlorine tablets, much like you would for keeping your chlorine in your pool, you can drain them out to the surface. There's also sand pits that you can run your water to if it's properly filtered and properly run through one of these sewage treatment systems. Cost-wise, the septic system is a little less expensive. Most of the motorized or aerated units, I believe you can get them installed anywhere from about $5,000 to $7,000, depending on how much excavation work is going to need to be done to get them hooked up. They do require a little bit of electricity to keep them running, and generally speaking, most areas make you keep some type of maintenance contractor with the installer so that they come out once a year or once every 2 years and change the filters and make sure that the unit is in operating condition so that the sewage water doesn't just start dumping out into the ditch in front of your house.
Okay. Well, other questions welcome here. Our guest is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on the program once a month. It's always on a Monday. We talk about home maintenance. And if you got some kind of problem, you need some advice, give us a call. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Is it too soon to start thinking about air conditioning?
Well, in Illinois, I can't say that. You never know. We have these huge weather swings. We might be needing it here shortly. Yes, it's too soon to do any real maintenance on your air conditioner system. Okay. The outdoor unit, of course, being exposed to outdoor temperatures, really for the Freon to ensure that the Freon is properly evaporated before it goes through the pump so we don't slug the pump. You really don't want to start operating it or checking it until it's been above 50 or 55 degrees for a couple of days and really warm things up. You try and test it or do so much with it earlier than that, and you take a chance of damaging it. So air conditioning at this point, you need to hold off just a little bit longer on it.
Okay.
Before doing anything. However, this is a really good time as the weather warms up to take a quick walk around the outside of the house and look and see if you've got any issues that you may not have seen before. We've had all winter when it was cold and nasty and a lot of snow, so the home maintenance is something we need to consider for spring. Take a walk around the outside of the house, take a look at the windows, see if we've got some missing caulk or putty around the windows, make sure we don't have any water running in around the windowsills. Take a look at the roof. Back up and take a good look at the roof. Make sure you don't have any shingles blown off. We've had some high winds. Of course, we are running into tornado season and such coming out. So after a really good high wind or nasty storm, it's always a good idea to take a walk around the outside of the house and look and see if something has happened that you weren't aware of, a tree branch pulling a shingle or two up, get the things like that to get taken care of so we don't end up with unexpected water leaks in our roof.
All right. We got some other calls here, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll go next to Terre Haute and talk to somebody here, line number four. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have a question for you.
Sure.
All right. I have, I'm getting some dampness through the basement walls.
Okay.
Not a lot, but enough to where you can notice it. So I'd like to know, since I'm not familiar with getting any of that into the basement, what do you suggest that I can put on the interior, maybe the exterior of the foundation wall to kind of block it up or dry it up?
Well, a concrete block wall has a hollow core in the middle of it. And so if you do get moisture to the outside, the water will soak through about an inch or so of concrete and find this hollow core, and then try and run down to the bottom. It actually can fill the block up at the core level, and well, once one block fills up, it flows into the next one and the next one and the next one. So you can get water. You could actually end up with a hydronic wall, basically a wall filled with water all the way around your basement or your foundation.
Oh, great.
Again, this is an indication of problems with surface drainage and a problem with guttering, because the water is not the artesian spring bubbling up from underneath. It is actually water that is soaking next to the foundation and into the foundation. There are several different products available where you can paint the concrete block to make it more impervious to water penetration. However, I don't usually recommend them inside the basement because, well, you don't really want to seal the boat after the water's got in. If you've got water getting into the foundation block, the problem isn't, gee, how do we keep it in the block? It's how do we keep it from getting into the block? And by putting on one of these waterproof paints inside the basement, you can actually fill the block up with water. Now, there's some basement waterproofing systems that will have you put the waterproofing on the inside and then install a tile or a sump pump and then drill some holes in the block to allow it to come out in designated areas so that you can control it. And if you've got a chronic water problem, someplace where you just can't get rid of water any other way, maybe a clay layer or something under the soil that directs water towards the foundation, then yes, you can put on one of these water systems on the inside, coat the block, and then put some drainage holes or a tiling system around the foundation block to collect the water at the bottom.
Okay.
But
yeah, that sounds more than what I was looking for. So then I have to dig up from the outside and figure out where the moisture's getting in.
Well,
there is an old cistern on that one corner where I'm getting the dampness.
Okay. Is the cistern still full of water, or is it an empty cistern, or have you filled it with sand and gravel? Or
No, it has some water in it. It's not completely full.
Okay. Well, that very easily could be the partial water source for that basement corner. Usually the cisterns were made out of brick, and brick is porous enough that if you try and hold 1,000 gallons of water alongside the foundation, that it can soak back through it. There's also a pipe that went from the cistern back into the basement because the cistern was used to collect the groundwater, or excuse me, the rainwater, and drain it into the house so that you had softer water for doing washing and such. So there is a pipe that actually goes to the basement, and if that pipe is rusted between the cistern and the house, it could be just allowing the soil to saturate. So okay. I do usually recommend filling of cisterns. If you can't knock the top off and fill it in from there, you can usually take the opening and just dump a good supply of sand, dirt, things like that in there to help prevent the water from standing there in large quantities.
Oh, good. All right. So that would be okay to fill that with just like sand. Well, yeah, sand and dirt.
Yep. Yeah, I backfill.
Okay. Not a problem. That's great. Thank you very much for your help, sir.
Certainly.
All right, thank you.
All right.
We will proceed. And next we'll talk with somebody on a cell phone, and that's on our line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Got a roofing question. I got about a 20-year-old ranch house. I'm looking to probably replace the roof in the next couple of years. And I'm looking at this fairly new product, I think. It's a metal shingle that actually has the aggregate attached glued to the metal shingle. Do you have any experience with those, or as far as installation or longevity?
To be quite honest, I have seen it at the builder trade shows, but I have not really acquired any information, and I don't know of any applications to where I can even base any information as to how long it lasts, how easy it is to install. So I'm going to have to say no. Unfortunately, I'm not real versed on that particular product.
I mean, one thing I really noticed, I'm out in the country, and they claim it's very good as far as wind, you know, durability.
That is correct. And metal roofing is making a comeback. I see more and more houses and more commercial businesses with the metal roofing.
My main concern is over time, will that aggregate come loose and wash off, you know?
Well, anytime you have something adhered to the metal, yes, the metal expands and contracts, so it's very difficult for them to get a glue or an adhesive that will last indefinitely. Luckily, most of the time the metal is durable enough that even though we lose some of the mineral granules or stuff, which were more for appearance than anything else, the roof still functions well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. So this is actually it's a piece of metal, and then the more conventional kind of shingle material that we're used to is actually glued onto that piece of metal.
Yeah, it's got an adhesive, and basically it's more of an aesthetics problem. A lot of people don't like the looks of a metal roof,
yeah.
And so they're making the metal look. Imitate either cedar shingles or standard asphalt shingles so that when you put it up there, you still have a 50-year product rather than a 20-year product. It does look more like a shingle, but like I say, that I have seen it at the trade show, but I haven't acquired enough information to really determine whether or not all the factory claims are as good. You know, advertising does wonders, but whether or not it actually works, I don't know.
Yeah. So that sounds like, though, you would expect this to have a longer life than an asphalt.
Yeah, a metal roof does have a good long life. Where we do run into problems with metal roofing, however, is ventilation issues. If you don't have extremely good ventilation in the attic with a metal roof, we get a lot of condensation problems, a lot of moisture collecting on the bottom side of the shingle or the metal roofing.
Mm-hmm.
So, ventilation becomes a big issue anytime you use a metal roofing.
All right. Next caller is in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello. I saw something. thing on television about a product that's a can be painted or applied to plywood for the floor of a shower. Have you seen anything of that sort? I assume it's an epoxy.
Yeah, they do make some epoxies. I don't know about applying it to a plywood. They also make some marine grade or foundation grade plywoods, which they use water resistant glues. But usually an epoxy paint or basically a liquid plastic will work for those types of situations if you've got a shower base that is porous enough or cracked.
Actually, what I was thinking of applying it to would be a greenhouse bench and filling it with water for capillary matting.
Okay.
And I was wondering if it would work for that.
Most of those will seal well enough that you could use a wood tray or wood as you're looking at a bench or something like that, some kind of trough type system.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, they do work for things like that.
Where would I find something like that?
That is a good question. I would start with a quick search on the internet because that it's specialized enough. It's hard to find in the local do-it-yourself stores because it's not something that moves on a regular basis. And
I would say
the first thing we're going to have to do is go back on the internet and do a quick search to see if you can figure out where you can find a supply for it.
I tried one of the local supply places, and they didn't have exactly what I was looking
for. Yeah, locally it's hard to find because it's not used often enough for them to actually stock items like that.
Mm-hmm. I think I saw it on This Old House where they tend to come up with somewhat exotic ideas.
Yeah, a little bit more obscure. Well, programs like that are very good for manufacturers getting new products out because they can get really good exposure. They can come up with a specialized use for it. I'm not going to say it's all This Old House is a paid commercial, but it's very close to that. It's amazing how many times a certain brand names came up. And when they find new products, they do like to show them off. And unfortunately, unless everybody is using something, you don't always find it in your area.
Sounds like it might be worth pursuing that.
Yes, if that's what you're trying to do for your greenhouse, I think it would work well.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go on to another Urbana person. This is line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I have a concrete slab in my that's attached to my driveway in my backyard, and it's very handy. We like having it because the kids can play on it, and you know, there's extra parking that way. But it, over time, it has sort of slanted toward the house, and actually so has the patio that's sort of attached to that. And that, whenever we have heavy rain, that means that it the water stands right there, right by our back door, which is really a pain. So I talked to some different people, to a concrete jacker, and then also to someone who suggested putting in a grate sort of right at the place where the water tends to congregate, and then you know, and somehow draining that out to the yard,
right?
Or just having it all taken out and re-poured. And I'm wondering if you have an opinion on it, especially concrete jacking, if that actually works, and then also those other options if one sounds better than the other.
Well, I would really rather not see the grate or drainage system because that means we're just going to throw up our hands and say, okay, the water's going back towards the house. Let's drain it away. I would rather see the water sloped away. The concrete raising or mud jacking is a good, viable system if the concrete slab is not in poor condition. If you've got a lot of cracks or breaks in it, you may want to think about re-pouring it. But if the concrete slab itself is in generally good condition, they can drill a few holes in it, and they use a hydraulic pump system to actually put a solution of concrete and water down underneath the concrete slab and hydraulically lift that edge of the slab back up and maintain a good slope away from the house. So if you've got enough room to do that, that is a very good alternative. Of course, re-pouring it is the last alternative, and that is, generally speaking, a little bit more expensive, but it is definitely a good way of going it if everything else does not work correctly. But if the slab is in good shape, I would say the mud jacking is a very viable, and I do recommend it on a regular basis for sidewalks, driveways, patios, etc.
And if it has a few cracks in the patio in particular, is that still a candidate for mud jacking?
Yes, it is. Usually there are some cracks, usually about 4 or 5 feet out from the house where as the soil is settled next to the foundation, it's allowed the crack, the concrete to settle and created that crack. And the mud jacking will raise it back up and actually minimize the crack. And then you can go through there with a crack sealant, one of these poly sealers or one of these epoxy sealers, and actually seal the cracks up afterwards.
Okay. Now, my only other question was part of it, like I told you, was right by the back door. So if they jack it up, is there going to be, are you going to have to step up to get out the back door? I mean, how much are we talking that they actually raise it? Is it only by like an inch or less than an inch?
It's all going to depend on that particular application. They can raise it as much or as little as what you need it. Uh-huh. Ideally, you want to raise it enough that you have a slope away from the foundation. If the soil out away from the house is high enough that we can't get that kind of a slope, then obviously the best thing there would be to take that particular slab out and pour a different one that you could lower the outside edge of it to get your slope away from the foundation.
Okay, thank you very much.
Uh-huh. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He is on the program once a month, always on a Monday, and we do this kind of thing. We talk about home maintenance. If you have a problem, you need some advice, give us a call. I know he'll do his best to help you. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Mantino, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question about home heating. I have a large two-story home in the country, and we've been heating with oil all these years,
mm-hmm.
and the price of oil now has gone up about 10 times about what it was 30 or 40 years ago. And I was thinking for an alternative for heating. That I mentioned I have hot water heat.
Okay.
And I was wondering about an electric boiler for my heating in my home.
Okay. Well, they do make electric systems. Generally speaking, the electric systems are not going to save you a lot on energy usage. It kind of depends on how much you're paying for oil versus how much you're paying for electric service. I have not actually come across anybody that has decided that it was more economical. How old is your current oil-fired boiler?
It's probably 15 years old.
Okay. So
year 20.
Okay, so it's not an ancient unit. Hopefully it's got a...
it's a Weil McLean.
Okay, so hopefully it's a relatively high efficiency unit.
Electricity is in my area. I have plenty of power on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
I have an 800 amp service, and our electricity is running about 10 or 11 cents. And versus oil is right at the last fill I got was right close to $3 a gallon.
All right.
And I just wondered, is there some sort of formula a person could use to tell if the kilowatts would produce enough BTUs to take care of its 10 room home?
Okay. I'm sure that there is. Yes, I know that there is a formula. I don't know it off the top of my head. I don't engineer and design those systems, so that's not something I would know. But yes, there are people that can help you with that. I would get with at least one or two contractors to put in that kind of system and talk with them. They should have those numbers available for you and be able to help you design and determine what size boiler you're going to need, what kind of BTU output you're going to need to handle that system.
Well, would you have a suggestion what I could use for an alternate fuel, wood or corn or something else that I could use for an alternate to oil?
Well, where you're, being out rural area like that, generally propane is the most common one that we find.
Yeah.
You can use the alternative fuels, your corn and your wood. Usually those systems require a lot more maintenance.
Yeah.
So while they may be a little bit less to operate from a strictly a number standpoint, because you end up putting a lot more time in it, it's not necessarily any cheaper because your time is worth money as well.
Right.
So those systems usually require a lot more maintenance and a lot more time consuming. So propane would be one way to look at it. And you'd have to do some studies to determine whether or not your propane usage versus your electric usage, which one would be more efficient for your area.
Yeah. Where would I find, you said to contact a contractor.
Yeah, I usually find one of the contractors that helps engineer or design these systems.
University doesn't have any data on that, do they, about the different fuels and what they cost and so forth?
At one point in time, they did have the Small Homes Council, Building Research Council doing things like that, but at the moment, I'm not so sure that they still do that type of work. You could probably give them a call and find out if they can give you help with that particular extension. It was the Small Homes Council and Building Research Council. My father was involved with their activities for 35 or 40 years, but they've kind of changed directions in the last few years, and I don't know how much of that they're still doing.
Okay. But would you think it wise to change? Maybe we should stay where we're at and just keep forging ahead with what we got.
Well, I would say that it's worth looking into to determine what's going on because, yes, oil is getting higher. The natural gas and propane is a little bit less expensive, but they're going up as well. So keeping a high-efficiency unit, you say you've got a 15- or 20-year-old boiler. Generally speaking, those Weil McLeans that I'm familiar with have a fairly high-efficiency rating, somewhere around 80% or so. I don't know. My guess would be that the propane would be a little bit more efficient than the oil because the propane has a little bit higher BTU volume-wise, so it might save you a little bit over the oil.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, thanks for your help.
All right, sorry I couldn't help.
We'll try and get at least one more in the time that remains here. We have about 2 minutes left, and we'll talk with somebody next in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was going to suggest to the gentleman that just called he should investigate geothermal type of heating and cooling. A good friend of mine out in Monticello put one in, and his heat bill last year was $19 for the whole year.
Geothermal is a very good way of doing it. It is also a very expensive initial cost to convert a system over that's already got another boiler system. But yes, the geothermal is very efficient and very effective. It's just got a very high initial installation cost.
Yes, it does.
So, but yeah, you're correct. That is a very viable alternative if we need to switch over. That way we can start doing things that the geothermal will either use an air-to-air heat exchange type system or even a ground loop where you can run a coolant media or a heating media, a liquid down into a loop in the ground and actually draw heat from the soil.
Yeah, it takes advantage of the fact that generally in the summertime the soil is cooler and in the wintertime it's warmer. So you can either get heat or dump off heat that way.
Yeah, but like I say, those type of units, a heat pump effectively, a geothermal system is a heat pump that is using the heat from the soil. Yeah. And quite efficient, but usually a lot of excavating and a lot of work to get them installed.
That's the problem, your upfront costs, and that can make it maybe it would be the kind of thing that if you were building a house and you were starting from the beginning, that would be a good thing to think about. But it may indeed get to be expensive if you have something else already. Well, you're talking about, well, what are you talking about, thousands of dollars?
Yes, actually it is extra, more over what a normal wood system would be. It's several thousand dollars. And they can run them in a couple different configurations. If you happen to have a lake on your property, it works well because they can just throw a loop out in the lake. But otherwise, you end up basically drilling a well and throwing a casing down into the ground and using your loop through the casing. Mm-hmm. But in a rural area where oil, as our caller was using, oil is about the only way to go, or a propane system, it's something that could be considered.
Okay. We have maybe about a minute or two left. And any last thing that you'd like to leave with folks?
Well, I'd really like to thank everybody for calling in. They seem to be doing a nice job keeping us busy over here. As far as last-minute stuff, well, prepare to batten down the hatches, because with the rainstorm that we're going to be getting here shortly, I fully expect to find some more wet basements and wet crawl spaces. So while we've got a little bit, half a day of decent weather, you might want to go out and double-check around that house. People are getting to the point where we just don't pay as much attention to the house and do the maintenance that requires. We're trying to make everything maintenance-free, and your home is not maintenance-free. If you keep up on it, it'll help take care of you, but if you let it lax and do what we call deferred maintenance, say, oh, I'll get to that next year, it can come back and bite you. So take a walk around the outside of the house and see what you can come up with as far as the condition of downspouts, grading, roofing, things like that.
Okay. And one other maintenance item, painting. When are we going to start thinking that it would be time where we could do painting? I know at outside temperatures, basically.
Outside temperatures and humidity levels. Painting in the spring usually doesn't do well because it rains almost every other time you turn around. And you need to make sure that any of the trim work is quite dry before you put the paint on it. So, yeah, that's usually a late spring, early summer type project.
Okay. And what kind of – I know this is something I've talked about with your dad a lot. What you would you recommend that the nighttime temperatures have to be at least at a certain level? I know, obviously, moisture, that's going to be an issue too. But to get the paint to really bond, it can't be too cold.
Yeah, just because you have one warm day where it's 70 degrees out, if it drops down to 50 or 60 in the evening, you know that the humidity level is going to jump up quite a bit and your paint's not going to cure correctly because it's going to be too moist in the evening. It's going to get condensation and things like that. So, yeah, you need to wait till the weather warms up just a little bit.
Yeah, all right. Well, I thank you very much. Appreciate you being here.
Well, David, thank you very much for inviting me.
Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on this program once a month. It's always on a Monday. And we offer you the opportunity to call in and ask these kind of questions on home maintenance. We also want to thank Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors for its support of Focus 580. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors offers pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors is pleased to support public radio in central Illinois on behalf of its customers and business associates. Reminder that coming up today on the Afternoon Magazine, a chance to ask a different kind of how-to question, and that is computers. They do this show also once a month. The guest this time around will be Peter Kimball. He is Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the FAST 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the U of I. So if you have computer problems, he will try and help you out. That's in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. We will take a break. We usually do. And when we continue, we'll be talking with historian Jerome Green about the history of the Little Bighorn Battlefield. First, though, a break for news and an update on the market. Stay tuned.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, resourceful by nature.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at midday. There is a lot of red on the screen, and many of the pits are limit down at the moment. In Kansas City, May wheat now trading at 1224 and a half, now 1221 down 39. July, 1190 down 31 and a half. At the Chicago Board of Trade, May wheat at 1167 and a quarter, down 24 and a quarter. July, 1134 and a quarter, down 27 and three quarters. July, 1134 and a quarter, down 27 and three quarters. May corn, 539 and a quarter, down 20. July, 551 and a quarter, down 20. September, 553 and a half, down 19 and three quarters. December of 2008 at 555, down 20. May beans, 1302 and three quarters, down 50. July, 1318 and three quarters, down 50.